Our lovely ushers and usherettes will hand those out to you. If you don't own a Bible, as I say here, just go ahead and take that Bible home with you. It is our gift to you. We'd love to help you out with that. So Mark chapter 5, I think the page is behind me on the screen, page 697, if you're using one of our Bibles that we present to you. If you're a guest with us, we have been studying on and off for the last year the book of Mark. We began this ministry back in September. Study in the book of Mark. We went through up to December, and then we took a break, went through the book of Philippians, and now we are back in it, and we will continue to spend time walking through this great gospel until we're finished, which should probably take us somewhere up near the end of the year. We may take a week or two break here and there for different things like our kickoff Sunday and things like that in September, but essentially we will be spending our time in this great, great book. We are in the first 20 verses of Mark chapter 5. If you have been around with us for a while, you will remember that we just finished off a couple of weeks ago looking at this event that's recorded for us in the last six or so verses of Mark chapter 4. It's an event where Jesus and his disciples are journeying on the Sea of Galilee. They encounter the storm. And although we are going to be studying the first 20 verses of Mark chapter 5, I actually want to begin our time by looking at verse 35 of chapter 4. And I want you to look specifically with me in verse 35 at this instruction. Pretty clear, simple instruction that Jesus gives to his disciples in this verse. He says this, "Let us go over to the other side." And if you remember, again, just reminding you of a couple of weeks ago, this begins this voyage with Jesus and his disciples and some other followers across the Sea of Galilee. It's on this voyage that they encounter this great storm where his disciples freak out. Jesus, remember, is sleeping. They rouse him up. Jesus wakes up and he calms this storm that had these fishermen and others, these experienced voyagers, absolutely terrified. And he calms this storm. Now, what I want to point out for you is I was preparing for our time this morning and sort of rereading, reviewing, kind of looking at the events leading up to Mark chapter 5, trying to get the context for what's going on. I came across verse 39 again in Mark chapter 4. And this is where Jesus confronts this storm. And he says this, "Jesus got up, he rebuked the wind and said to the waves, 'Quiet, be still.' Then the wind died down and it was completely calm." It was completely calm. Now we're going to come back to this and again, but I want to just spend some time before kind of dividing up and looking and kind of unpacking that verse by asking this simple question. Why did Jesus want to go to the other side? What was about going to the other side that was all important that he would voyage and journey on over there? I'm absolutely convinced when you read the Gospels, the stories of Jesus, that Jesus didn't just do things in sort of a happenstance manner, that there was purpose, there was guidance. He had a clear direction that he had to go to the other side. He had to do something on the other side. Now, for those of you that have sort of cheated a little bit, you've looked ahead to chapter 5 and you got those little headings at the beginning of your chapters, you'll see that Jesus goes on to the other side. And what happens in these first 20 verses is that he heals a man who had been possessed by, as we will see, many, many demons. And you know what? If you were to answer the question, why did Jesus have to go to the other side simply because he wanted to heal a man possessed by demons, you would be right, but you'd only be right partially. You'd only be right partially because there is something that is going to happen that is so much bigger than just the healing of a demon-possessed man, although that's a great deal. That's pretty cool. That's something you don't see every day unless you kind of go to freaky movies and things like that. So that's kind of a neat deal all by itself. But something bigger is going to happen in these 20 verses. Before we start unpacking it again, let me tell you why I'm excited to go through these 20 verses. I'm excited to go through these 20 verses for basically three reasons. And the three reasons are really encompassed in perhaps three different groups of people that are sitting here this morning. I'm excited about going through this passage with you because perhaps there are some of you in this theater this morning who think you are too far gone for God. Perhaps thinking that at the very least, if you're not too far gone for God, then you are too far gone to be used by God. And so I'm excited to walk through this passage with you this morning because this passage is going to speak into your life a little bit. I'm convinced of that. I'm also excited to go through this passage because some of you may be wondering if your life matters. I mean, what difference can one person make in this journey called life, in this place where 6 billion or so people exist? And so if you are struggling with this idea of, you know what, my life doesn't matter, I can't make a difference, what can I do all by myself, then I'm excited to walk through this passage with you because this passage, I'm convinced, is going to speak to you as well. I'm also excited to speak to one other group here this morning. I'm excited to speak to the person or people in this theater this morning who have a great passion to do great things for God. And you're actually very convinced that God has called you to something. He's called you to participate in something. And some of you are even at that stage in your life right now where you're excited to do something for God. You feel absolutely convinced that God is calling you to something. You've said yes to it, but as soon as you started walking in obedience to that, you've only faced opposition after opposition and roadblock after roadblock. You ever felt like that? And so I am excited to walk through this passage with you because I think if you fit in any one of those categories, this passage will speak into your life. It's this last group of people, this group of people who feel called by God to do something that leads to our first point, I guess, first statement of truth, whatever you want to call it. It's actually a pre-point. It's not even a point. It's a pre-point. We haven't even looked at a verse yet. So how can you have a point when you haven't looked at a verse yet? It's a pre-point. Here's the first pre-point. It's going to seem rather simple to you, but let me, again, maybe unravel it for you. It's this. Anytime you feel called by God to do something, expect opposition along the way. And as I mentioned, Jesus felt like he had to go to the other side. And as some of you cheaters have already seen, Jesus goes to the other side and he heals this man who had been possessed by demons. And I'm convinced that Jesus, again, didn't do things on a whim. Jesus says in a variety of places, specifically in the book of John, however, that he doesn't do anything unless God tells him to, his Father tells him to. And so Jesus says to his disciples, I want to go to the other side. But as soon as he begins that journey, he begins to meet opposition. The first resistance that Jesus encounters was this storm. We're not going to look at it a lot. We already looked at it a couple of weeks ago. But I want you to come back to that verse I inferred to where we just kind of touched upon verse 39. Because he gets into this trip across to the other side with his disciples and this storm he encounters. And then in verse 39, look at it again. I'll read it one more time because it's pretty interesting. Maybe you've never picked it up before. Jesus gets up. Remember, he's sleeping. He wipes the long hair out of his eyes because remember, Jesus has long hair. We've seen the pictures. He got up. He rebuked the wind and he said to the waves, quiet, be still. Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. Now, let's just stop there for a second. I don't know if any of you have ever calmed wind. Okay, I haven't. But to me, it seems that if you have the power and authority as Jesus being God did, it would make sense that he did what he did. That he said, as he says, quiet, be still. I mean, saying it out loud to the wind, that makes sense. I don't know what else you can say. That seems like an obvious thing. Quiet, be still. Glass. I mean, just nice. Everything is, the water is just completely calm. Great. Great, great water skiing. I mean, just right away, just calm, just like that. I mean, it is a divine moment. It's a Genesis 1 moment where God speaks and the elements obey. What doesn't make sense to me, however, is what Mark points out at the very beginning of that verse. It says that Jesus got up and he rebuked the wind. Why? Why would you rebuke wind? I mean, wind's just being wind, right? I mean, why would you rebuke the wind? I mean, that seems like rebuking rain for being rain. Or rebuking thunder for being thunder. I rebuke you for being who you are. Doesn't make any sense. Unless there's something else going on that isn't isn't readily apparent on a first reading. I find it interesting that Jesus, in standing up against this storm and rebuking it and telling it to be quiet and be still, in this story, is the exact same thing with the exact same language as he does when he encounters the first demoniac back in Mark chapter 1. He encounters that demoniac, if you remember, in the synagogue, begins his ministry, and he rebukes that demoniac, and he says, quiet, be still. You're going, what's your point? My point is this. And for some of you, you're going to think, man, if you just walked in for the first time, you're going to think I'm some kind of nut job. But I'm absolutely convinced that there is demonic elements, demonic power behind this storm that Jesus encounters. That the first opposition that Jesus encounters with his disciples on the way to the other side isn't simply some storm, but it's a storm of opposition that has demonic power behind it. Now you're going, do you think all storms have demonic power behind it? No, I don't. I don't believe there's demons behind every tree and demons involved in every event. I'm not that guy. However, I do know from reading the scriptures that Satan has great power and authority. You read the first chapter of the book of Job, and you know that Satan can work in the elements. Jesus himself says in his own teaching that Satan has great power to do false miracles, signs, and wonders. I also know that we have an enemy that prowls. We have an enemy that looks for opportunities to devour. We have an enemy who's a liar. We have an enemy who is an accuser. We have an enemy that brings great doubt. We have an enemy that opposes us when we want to get to the other side. Isn't that true? So we have Jesus and his disciples having to get to the other side, and they meet this first bit of opposition. You go, you're out to lunch, funk. Okay. Just my opinion, all right? Just my opinion. But I think there is something significant in Jesus rebuking this wind and it becoming calm. It's a great sign of superiority and power and authority. And we shouldn't be surprised that Jesus encounters this. Now, that shouldn't cause us to fear, because remember the storm event of Mark chapter 4 is where Jesus, he just speaks into the storm, and again, he displays his great power and authority over it. He ultimately has absolute power over that storm. And as we will see in a moment, he's going to display that power again in just a second when we get to Mark chapter 5. But we also need to remember, even though Jesus has great power, authority, and demonstrates his superiority over the elements and over the things that oppose him, that doesn't stop Satan and his minions, his demons, to try to thwart us. They're in opposition to us. For example, Paul, the apostle, the writer of the book of Philippians and many other books in the New Testament, the one who sets an example for us, he writes this in 1 Thessalonians, and you can read it over my shoulder on the screen. He puts it this way. He says, brothers, when we were torn away from you for a short time, in person, not in thought, out of our interest, intense longing, we made every effort to see you, for we wanted to come to you. Certainly I, Paul, did again and again, but Satan stopped us. It happened to Paul and it happened to Jesus many times, many places, many events. That's why Hebrews 12, great passage, great couple of verses in the first part of that chapter. The writer of Hebrews just exhorts us. And he says this, fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. We shouldn't be surprised that we have opposition from the spiritual realm. It's exactly what Ephesians 6 says to us, makes this abundantly clear when it states, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. We have an enemy. We have an enemy. And there's great opposition when we want to go to that other side. Whatever that other side is, we will stand against those who oppose us. That's why, and this is why I'm giving an announcement in regards to it. One of the things that we are starting, and we will sign up today, there'll be a sign-up list over at the Connect Center. We want to just take our prayer ministry to another level. If you have a heart to be a part of a prayer ministry here at the church, to pray for the needs that we have, to pray for certain events specifically, to just stand along this ministry in a very concentrated way, we will have a sign up. There will be a sign up at the Connect Center, because we know that we can't just battle through our own wit, our own wisdom, so-called, our own desires, that this is a battle of spiritual proportions. And so we need to stand then in the spiritual realm, in the prayer realm. That's what the end of chapter 6 of Ephesians talks about. So Jesus was called to go to the other side for a purpose, and he immediately faced opposition from and in the storm. But it didn't end there, and that leads to the first verse of today's passage. How are we doing? We good? Good. All right, here we go. Stop wasting my time. All right, verse 1. Just kidding. You know I'm kidding. Chapter 5, verse 1, it begins this way. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. Let's stop there. Let's just stop there. Let me put this in context. Let's remember where we're at. Jesus has just come from just outside of the city of Capernaum, the town, really. The town of Capernaum, if you remember way back to October, is north, right? This is Israel, right? North, up past my ring. Let's call that Samaria. Okay, go north into the region of Galilee. There's a city called, or a town called, Capernaum, which is located on the Sea of Galilee. A lot of Jesus' ministry took place in and around Capernaum. And that's basically where Mark has been for most part of what we've read thus far. And so he's just outside of the region, about outside of the town of Capernaum. He gets into the boat. And he leaves Capernaum, this region situated in Galilee, which predominantly is Jewish. And he travels about 10 to 12 kilometers over the Sea of Galilee to the east. And he lands in this area, which is in the region of the Decapolis, a region of 10 cities that were governed by the Romans, had the authority. The Romans had authority over them. It's this region. And here's what I want to point out right from the beginning. This is a predominantly Gentile region. So even though the trip has only been 10 to 12 kilometers over the Sea of Galilee, the difference in the makeup of the people is entirely different. So this is where Jesus and his disciples have landed. Let's pick up the story. Let's read verses 2 to 5, and then we'll stop. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him night and day. Among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. If you've been following along with us, you'll know that this is the third demoniac that Mark has highlighted in his gospel. But by far, this is the most graphic and horrific one that has been encountered. This man is in such a state of torment that he is living in tombs. And he was not only a terror to others, but he was a terror to himself. He would sit and cut himself with stones, Mark tells us. It's obvious that people lived in fear of him because they had tried to often, it said, subdue him with chains and iron. But they couldn't. Their efforts were futile. But then along came Jesus. And then along came Jesus. From a Jewish perspective, you couldn't get a more sort of description of uncleanliness than the description that Mark gives us of this situation. You have a man who's a Gentile, most likely, possessed by an evil or an unclean spirit. He's living in a Gentile region among tombs of the dead. If you were a Jewish person and you came in contact with something that was dead, you had to take a 7-day process of purification before you would be allowed back into your community. We have a man living in the tombs among the dead. in a Gentile region with unclean spirits. Add on top of that, we're going to see in just a moment that this is in a region where pig herders are present. You couldn't have a worse area for a Jewish person to come into. They wouldn't be caught dead or alive in this area. But then along came Jesus. Why? Why did Jesus go here? Because he had to go to the other side. Even though he would face opposition, he had to go to the other side. Even though he would find himself in the midst of all things horrific, he had to go to the other side. Let me ask you a question, because the application is right in front of us, isn't it? Where is God calling you to go? Where is God calling you to go? What is God calling you to do? Has God called you to something, and right when you said yes, you started facing opposition in all sorts of places? Maybe your opposition is external. Maybe your opposition is storm-like. Maybe your opposition is internal. Maybe you're full of doubt and worry and anxiety. You're full of discontentment. Maybe God has called you to something, and right now all you see around you is filth and dread, and you're wondering if any good can come out of it. What's God calling you to do? Well, let's keep on reading and see what happens, because it is such a great story. Let's pick it up in verse 6. It says this: when he, that's the demoniac, saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. That term legion, by the way, it's a Roman troop classification that refers to a troop of soldiers numbering 5,600. Now, we don't know if exactly 5,600 demons were in this man, but we do know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there were many, because it says so in the passage. There are many, many demons in this man. There's a lot of things that we could pick out in these verses. I just want to highlight a couple of them. First, just to note, just to make sure we're really clear about this, I want you to note the clear recognition by the evil spirit that it was absolutely subservient to Jesus. Absolutely. To quote one author, and I love this, when demoniac meets divine, it's a no contest event. He was absolutely subservient to Jesus. Here's the second thing I want you to note. This evil spirit did not want Jesus in this place. The way Mark writes it, you get this sense that there is great opposition to Jesus in this area, don't you? They had this area. We see in verse 10 that when they make this brash request to Jesus to not have Jesus send them out of the area. Why? I don't know. How's that for an answer? I'm not sure. I read 4 commentaries, 5 messages, 5 sermons on this passage, and not one of them are really clear about why. I will say this when it comes to this text, that this is one of the passages where people build their theology for ideas like territorial demons or spirits. I don't know where I stand on that. I don't. I'm open. I'm cautious. I want to discern. I don't want to be one of those guys who, again, finds demons around every tree, every corner, and every event. But I do know this. Regardless of what your theology is in regards to a discussion like this, these demons didn't want to go out of this area. We do know that, and it's really clear for us here. At the very least, this is what we, I think, can assume, and we can make, I think, some solid conclusions in regards to it. This area, the Decapolis, was certainly dominated by demonic forces who were absolutely hostile to the arrival of Jesus. However, in spite of their domination over this area, they offered no resistance to Jesus. And they had to plead again and again for the mercy of Jesus as the only alternative to experiencing his wrath. And this is, and it's found in this request of these demons to Jesus to stay in this area, where we begin to get some sense of why Jesus had to go to the other side. Yes, he had to go to the other side to heal this man, but there's something bigger going on here than first meets the eye. And let's pick it up again, because it even gets better. All right, here we go. In the Bible, great. You're going, yeah, I hope so. Verse 11, this is where it gets kind of funky. Verse 11, a large herd of pigs, here's these pigs, was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, that doesn't mean there are 2,000 demons, there could have been more, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. This is a weird set of verses. Come on, let's be honest. It's a weird set of verses. You know, you just hope when you get to heaven, you just hope they had, you know, they took some video footage, right? You just want to see that. I don't know. You got a lot of time to check things out. I'm getting sacrilegious. I shouldn't do that. What's going on here? Well, you know, here's the troubling part of these verses. The big troubling part, it may have come out to you, is why would Jesus grant permission to demons at all? Why would you grant their request? Why would you do that? Why would you have any sympathy? Why would you say okay to anything a demon said or asked or wanted? And again, I don't know. I don't know. And nor is there, I think, at least the ones I've come across and read, there's nobody that really does know why Jesus allowed this. There are some ideas out there, but we don't know for sure, other than to say this. I do think there is something dramatic and convincing about the demons going into the pigs that would have convinced the onlookers that something had taken place, right? Jesus gave proof to all the spectators that a miracle of deliverance had really taken place. You know, some, it's funny, I think, maybe not to some of you, they sort of have an ethical dilemma about these 2,000 pigs getting killed. I don't know what to say to you. To my vegan friends out there, I just want you to understand that the soul of this one man is worth far more than the death of the 2,000 pigs. I know, and I love bacon. And so, you know, but you need to understand that that has been written about. But I think we get a picture of the worth of this one man. He's worth at least 2,000 pigs. Let's pick up the story. This actually goes online. I can't believe it. We're going to get letters. Verse 14, here we go. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this. Why? Probably because they were scared they're going to get fired. If you were in charge of a herd, they all died. Why would you do that? Partially, I think, because they were frightened. Reported this in town and country and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. The rest of the story, starting here in verse 14, really centers on the reaction of the people in the event of this exorcism. Those responsible for the tending of the pigs, they run and they tell people what had happened. And what stands out in the receiving of this news, of this miracle that had taken place, and seeing for themselves what had happened, that the people of the town had the same reaction that the disciples did in witnessing Jesus' power and authority and superiority over the storm. At the end of verse 15, you read, they were afraid. The comparison between the story of the storm and this one is readily apparent, isn't it? I mean, think about it. You witness in both this story of the storm and the story of this healing of the demoniac, the power of Jesus over the events. You have this chaos going on that nobody has any control over it. And Jesus comes along and he calms both situations. But both situations, if you picked it up, end in fear. The disciples were afraid of the storm, but they were terrified of Jesus at the end of Mark chapter 4. Who is this guy? Who is this guy? They were afraid of the demoniac. They tried to subdue him. Jesus comes along, subdues him, and they were really afraid of Jesus. So much so that at the end of verse 17, they plead with him, Jesus, to leave their region. Don't gloss over that reaction too quickly. Get out of here. We don't want you here. Can I say this as a point of, I guess, application? I hear a lot of people today praying and wondering and wanting to see God do something spectacular, something over the top, some stunning manifestation of power. And we all do. I want to see that as well. We all want to see God work in supernatural ways. But the fact of the matter is, historically speaking, scripturally, and I think it's true even today, that when God manifested himself, whether it was in Jesus himself or in the miracles that Jesus performed, the reaction at best by most was that they didn't change. At worst, they asked him to leave. Some, even in the aftermath of Jesus doing great things, wanted to kill him. Why? Well, I think there are a few reasons why, but I believe the most common one is found in John chapter 3, coming from the mouth of Jesus himself. He puts it this way. You can see it on the screen behind me. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has done has been done through God. In other words, this is what Jesus is saying, is that when you encounter me, it demands a response. Because you will be confronted with many, many things. When you confront the real Jesus, the Jesus of the Bible, a response is demanded. Because you're being confronted with truth and light. And you can't come in contact with truth and light without making some sort of response to it. That's why we don't finish with this. We finish with a time of response. Because we want to allow people in our messages and our times together on Sunday to respond to what Christ is telling them through his word. What do you do with Jesus? You know what? I could soft sell you Jesus. I could. I could soft sell you Jesus and say that if you follow Jesus, he will give you a happy marriage. Or he will make you a successful salesman. Or that he will give you a lot of friends. Or that everything in your life will go well with you. But I can't do that, honestly. And ultimately, it's not my desire that you have a happy marriage. Or that you are a successful salesman. Or that you have a lot of friends. Do I hope you do? Yeah. Do I think the scriptures can help you with that? Absolutely, I do. In all those areas. I think it can help you be a better person when you follow God. But there's so much more. See, it's not my desire to make sure that the events of your life go well. My desire, more than anything else, is to help you follow Jesus. The same Jesus who, when you come into contact with him, he may call you to sell everything. Give it all away and follow him. I may put you in contact with a Jesus who may, when you give your life to him and you bring that relationship into your family, it will divide it down the middle. I may call you to come in contact with a Jesus who says to you, consider the cost before you follow me. Make sure that you can complete the task. I may put you in contact with a Jesus who says to you, pick up your cross every day and follow me. How's that for a sales pitch? You see, there's a lot of churches that will say, we want you to come into a safe place. This is not a safe place. Because spirituality isn't safe. Dealing with eternity isn't safe. It's life-changing. It's exciting. It's awe-inspiring when God invades your life. But it ain't safe. It can be really scary. It can. But man, it's awesome. I can guarantee you this, if you're living a life, and I don't care what kind of life you got right now, and it doesn't have Jesus in your life, you're not experiencing life to the full, because Jesus said, if you follow me, I will give you life to the full, abundant. Here's my promise. There's a chance that if you follow Jesus, you'll make less money, that you'll have less friends, and things won't go entirely well for you every day. Follow Jesus. Follow Jesus. How about that? How to decrease numbers in your church. But that's the Jesus of the scriptures. And it's great. It's great. Where were we? Let's finish the story. I love how the story ends. I love how the story ends. Pick it up, verse 18. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, go home to your family and tell him how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. Back at the beginning of our time together in chapter 4, I said and repeated what Jesus said to his disciples, let's go to the other side. Why? For one reason. To see a man rescued from the bondage of Satan, but it didn't end there. The people of the region wanted Jesus out of there. He faced opposition in going there. They wanted him back to where he came from. This man was set free by Jesus, and he wanted to come and follow Jesus. But Jesus says in verse 18, go and tell your family what the Lord has done for you. You see, people may want to banish Jesus, but Jesus will always be present in the testimony of his followers. You cannot shut up Jesus. I love what verse 20 says. So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. Here's the bigger story. I talked about something bigger going on here. Here's the bigger story. In the Gospel of Mark, this becomes the first missionary preacher sent out by Jesus. Isn't that great? He became the first missionary of Jesus to the Gentiles, a mission that flourished after the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. He went from being a possessor of demons to a professor of Jesus. In an afternoon. No seminary training. Hadn't done a lot of reading. Hadn't even come across C.S. Lewis yet. And he's telling people about Jesus. But he didn't know everything. He knew what Jesus had done for him. And that's all that Jesus asks of us. Tell people what Jesus has done for you. Do you feel called to something this morning, but you're facing great opposition in the process? Are you feeling discouraged because your effectiveness of ministry is only reaching a few and you're wondering if your life matters? Or are you wondering if your past has exempted you from ministry, that there is no way anyone would listen to you? If that's you, then I encourage you to make this story your story, a story where Jesus had to go to the other side. where he battled through storm and opposition to reach a demoniac of all people who in one day became a missionary to the people that he lived with, that he had encountered, that at one time were fearful of him. He didn't know much, but he knew about Jesus. There's one other person that I want to talk to this morning. And it's the person this morning that is encountering Jesus in your heart, in your soul, in your spirit, in that place where you live, in that place where nobody else knows about except you, the place where you try to keep hidden from everybody else. And you know in that place, in your gut, that Jesus is right and true and real. And you feel called. You feel like he's knocking. You feel like he wants you to follow him, and you're still fighting him. You're still pushing him away. Will you respond today to the change that Christ offers? Or are you afraid of him and afraid of the change that he is calling you to? Are you willing to give him everything? Or will you sit there simply amazed, even fearful of him, yet still walk away? Don't push Jesus away if you're encountering him today. Give your lives to him. There's a whole gamut of people that this passage speaks to, regardless of where you are at in your journey of faith. I talked about some at the beginning. I'm ending with talking about others. But this passage, I would guess, if you're at all open to God speaking to you, finds you in it somewhere. As we go to a time of response, please don't just make this another time of religiosity, of just going to church again. We have no desire for that. We want you to respond to what the Spirit is saying to you through his word. Will you respond to him? If you need to give your life to him, give your life to him. If you need to come to him because you're trying to battle the storms on your own and you're fearful, as we all would be when we try to battle on your own, would you come to him and allow him to journey with you so that it's no longer you in charge? If you've been living in doubt and wondering, does God really want to use me? Would you respond to him by saying, God, I believe you do. I want to take captive those thoughts that are disobedient to the things of Christ. Follow you, believing that you can use me. If he can use a demoniac, he can use me. And I want to tell others about Jesus. Let's pray. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for your word. Your word is so good. It is so good. Thank you for the truth in it. I thank you that it's life-changing. Father, we thank you for Jesus. It is all about Jesus. He is the author. He's the perfecter. We want to fix our eyes on Jesus. He is the example setter. We want to have the attitude and mind of Jesus who faced great opposition, but with the joy set before him, endured it. Father, we want to be like Jesus. Father, in our time of response, I pray that people would have the courage to respond to what you're calling them to, regardless of where they're at in their walk with you. We pray for all these things in Jesus' great name. Amen. As I said, we always...